And the ask was, why is it that we buy these little companies, they're so innovative, they're so disruptive, they're doing amazing things, we buy them, and then all the innovations that they do after that are just so incremental and they don't really have as much impact anymore. Like, what's going on?
Hello and welcome to Clinical Changemakers, the podcast that explores vital lessons in healthcare leadership, innovation, and so much more. I'm your host, Dr. Jono. Today on the podcast, we have Dr. Josh Macau. He's the director and co-founder of Stanford's BioCenter for Biodesign. He's a founder and board member of multiple successful healthcare device companies. Dr. Macau holds over 300 patents and patent applications for various medical devices. So let's begin. Dr. Josh Macau, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we jump into your skills and experiences in the innovation space, I'd love for you to perhaps talk about any interesting or innovative products that you're working on at the moment.
I think the special one in mind for me is a company called MoxiMed. And so this is a treatment for early stage osteoarthritis, but it doesn't invade the joint and it does not require any damage to the joint. It's completely extracapsular, but subcutaneous.
For our listeners, Josh is holding up an object about the size of your pinky finger. It's shaped like the capital letter I and works as a shock absorber, so basically can get taller or shorter, absorbing excess forces on the knee. It's fitted in the vertical or upright position on the inside aspect of your knee, underneath the skin, but not inside the knee joint.
And it's like perfectly applied unloader brace on the outer surface, and then as you walk, it actually provides a counter force when you start to bring your knee into alignment, and that's of course when the bearing surfaces start to touch each other. So it actually pushes the femur away from the tibia on the medial side, which is the part that makes the most contact because most of us are bow-legged, and that's why osteoarthritis starts medially. But it doesn't invade the joint. And instead of being it on the skin and causing abrasion, it's a pain in the neck, you can't get your pants over it, it's awkward, you forget to bring it with you when you walk. This is in there all the time. And thus, it immediately or relatively shortly after the procedure reduces pain dramatically, improves function. And that's what the FDA gave us approval for this week. We can now sell this in the United States after 10 years of work. And a lot of dedication and perseverance and challenges and setbacks and all those things. And we finally brought it to the market and now patients can benefit from this. It's going to be really, really exciting.
Wow, what a fascinating tool. I really like how, some first principles of physics, I guess, is being used there. As our population's age, this seems like a really useful tool to reduce the amount of arthritis out there. I wonder, does this stop people from needing to have a joint replacement?
Yes and no. So when you're in your 30s and you have early stage osteoarthritis, or if you're in your 40s, maybe even in your 50s, the last thing they want to do is replace your knee. Because when you do that, that's an artificial joint. It's going to be under tremendous stress. And they need to be replaced almost every 10 years. So if you get in the age of 30s, you get in one in 40, you get in one in 50. I mean, every other replacement is fraught with many more complications and many more challenges. And so it is much better to avoid a total knee as long as you can. And that's why many people of early stage osteoarthritis, are getting things like hyaluronic acid injections or maybe trimming of meniscus or other things, which have been shown not to have great outcomes, but there's nothing else. This finally is something that those people can use. Now, if you've got advanced osteoarthritis, this is not for you. This is early when it's maintained to the medial aspect of the joint, which is generally where it starts, but it is not for someone who is really a good candidate for a total knee. But this is hopefully to avoid ever needing a total knee. You can take the load off, let the bones heal, let the cartilage adjust. And thus far, very few people in our trial actually went on to get total knee. Now it's early, we probably have maybe 5 or 7 years of data. So it's early days, but it's very promising. I mean, that's what we do this for. Try to create opportunities to improve patients' lives, give them an alternative that doesn't exist today to, improve the quality of life.
And I'll be curious to know a little bit about how
particularly for medical devices, how the sort of testing process works for, you know, we know that when foreign bodies get under your skin, your body has a reaction to that and often tries to wall it off and all of those kinds of defensive type mechanisms. How do you test devices and make sure that first stage is well covered?
I mean, obviously, depending on whether you're using, you know, doing something that just temporarily intervenes with the body or is implanted is very, very different. And the materials that you have to choose are different. If you're going to be implanting something, you have to worry about all the things you're mentioning. I think as a designer, you are best to work with the body, understanding how it's going to react and utilize that reaction to your benefit, rather than fighting it. You know, sometimes you have to fight it, but it's harder. It's a lot easier to do things that the body likes, that it supports the outcomes because you've managed the challenges well and minimized the challenges that you're presenting to the body. Therefore, minimally invasive, therefore, materials that are very biocompatible. Those are the types of things that you can do to have the body less likely reject what you're attempting to do.
A few things that we've touched on in talking actually harken back to a lot of your education, you know, doing engineering at MIT and then going on to medicine at NYU. I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you maybe compare or even contrast those two educations. What is the stylistic differences and approaches to problems that might be interesting to compare?
You know, I've business school, medical school, and engineering school, and they're all so different, but all incredibly enriching. Being an engineer and being a mechanical engineer, the thing that I was drawn to is systems dynamics. And actually, I wound up being a TA in that class. This is this kind of unifying theory that ties electrical, thermal, mechanical, fluid all together with a similar framework. And the reality that all those things are flowing energy in different ways, and explaining how that happens through these different type of phenomenon is awesomely cool. And it means you can design anything, fluid, thermal, electrical, mechanical. It's like, it's all the same basic framework. And that is cool as a designer, as a inventor, like having that toolkit's pretty neat. And I loved engineering school because it was about solving problems and taking an understanding of how the world works, reducing it to basic bits, and then using those basic bits to recombine them to create solutions to the problems. So it's cool. Loved engineering school. Medical school is very different. There's so many things, at least when I was going through, that we didn't understand, that we could only describe empirically. Like, we do this and then we do that. Why? Don't ask that question. It just is. Like, I was the engineer coming into medical school, and people, would you stop asking those questions? It's not on the test. We don't need to know. Like, well, I'm just curious. Like, how does this thing work? But I loved and was fascinated by the human body and how complex it was and beautiful. And just, it's just an amazing universe of incredible complexity that we've only scratched the surface of. And it's pretty awe-inspiring. And so, you know, the opportunity to combine those two things, you know, the understanding of mechanics and the bringing the understanding of like how this amazingly complex system works is really awesome. It's like two awesome things put together. And the, you know, it's like Steve Jobs would say, like, he just wants to make a dent in the universe. Like, I sort of feel like that with the human, like, if I could just make a positive dent, you know, like, that would be a great contribution, because this is amazing, complex system that no human could ever conceive of fully in design. But to be able to do something that actually makes it work better is like it's like redirecting the light from the sun to go one place or another. It's like, that'd be cool. But then the realization that those two things alone aren't the way to get there, and then to come to business school and see how do you actually make things induce investors to part with their money to invest in new ideas that hopefully provide a return, and then they get rewarded, but at the same time you can use that vehicle to create entities that would then go on and help people create new medicines or technology is also a cool piece of the puzzle for me. So those are my three educational experiences that I sort of weave together to create the ability to impact patient care. So very different, but all really awesome.
I mean, it sounds like you found yourself at the right job with all of that background. And I guess what I'm hearing is around, you know, business school helps innovations scale and become sustainable. And I think sometimes in medicine, we can lose sight of the need for these sorts of things to be able to grow and spur on further innovations as well. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what do you think most doctors or medical professionals get wrong or don't quite grasp in the engineering and business space?
I mean, they're really different. They're really different ways of thinking. And you don't really need to know those things to be a really good physician. But if you want to be an inventor or an entrepreneur, an innovator, it's really helpful to have those pieces in some way, either yourself or on your team, you know. And there's many other schools that I didn't go to, so I still need to have a team. And it's good to know what you don't know well, but I think it would be good for physicians to have an open mind about new technologies and new approaches. I think that when we go through training, we learn in a certain way. This is the way you do it. And sort of because, like, historically, people haven't understood, like, why? And the answers are not really forthcoming, why? You know, so why do you do it? Because that's the way I was trained. This is what you do. When you see this, you do that. That's medicine. You learned it. They memorized it. But they didn't necessarily spend time dwelling on, like, why do you do that? And sometimes it's there. There's a theory. There's some scant evidence. But that evidence changes over time. And there are new insights that come with new experiments. And so I think it would be great if, you know, everyone approaches medical school to be open-minded to the fact that everything can be disrupted. And they could play a role in that disruption appropriately and safely, I think is the right framework. But yeah, it's constantly changing.
Reflecting on my own medical background, is thinking about risk tolerance. And I think we in medical school and in our training, our risk tolerance is often very, very low. But what is implicit in having a, you know, very high an aversion to risk is actually we're accepting a status quo. So it means that we aren't necessarily going to grow and improve if we aren't going to, as you say, safely approach innovation. So I think that's certainly something that is culturally a bit of a mindset in the medical field. Do you think there are particular fields within medicine that are more open to innovation?
Definitely. I mean, I've worked in a number of fields, and some have been hostile to innovation and others have been embracing of it, even when it's not worthwhile, because they just have this attitude of, like, the new is cool, the new is worth trying, new could change the world. And there's some specialties highly interested and engaged about new technology. And I think to this day have a culture of innovation that's very refreshing and exciting. And then, you know, there are other specialties where it's been tougher. It's been hard. I think we've played a role in changing some of that with some of my companies. I think ENT, for example, I think was tough. You know, we had a number of folks that embraced our ideas and they were successful and I went on to build practices around our technology and stuff. And then there were a bunch of physicians that tried everything they could to destroy us, quite honestly, and it made it so hard, which was very unfortunate for their patients, if no one else, and also for us and for them too. I mean, I would have wished that they would have been a little bit more open-minded.
And could you say that there's anything specific about how these cultures have emerged in terms of their embracing of innovation? I mean, is it a historical feature of leaps that some of them have made, or their particular structures or parts of how they interact with the human body that make them, you know, perhaps more ripe for the kind of innovation that you work on?
It's a good question. I've definitely seen it evolve. Like right now, ENT, I feel, is much more embracing technology. I see so many new startup companies. A lot of the docs that gave us problems are now involved with early stage startups. So, you know, we had a good outcome. We had a good financial outcome. We had a good clinical outcome. And so maybe they came out of that thinking, okay, maybe this is a worthwhile path and maybe it's not disreputable to work with a small company. So that created that culture of change. And maybe they also felt like, wow, those people won and I fought them and I didn't get to participate in that. Maybe I should next time think differently when the next thing comes in. And it seems like many have. So that's good for the specialty and good for patients. And I think it's changing. Those things are changing. I would probably say even those folks that are now engaged in innovation that were really harsh against us early, I think they probably see the changes as positive overall. When I went to medical school, I don't know about you, but like the first day of class, the dean of the medical school said, half of what we're going to teach you is wrong. We just don't know which half. That's a good mindset. But I think sometimes people forget it, especially when they go down the specialty route and they feel like paid all these dues to finally get there. Like this is the way the world is. And then for some young upstart group come in and blow it all up. It's like, who are you? And don't disrupt me. Anyway, I do see change. So that's
some,
good.
Some optimism there and some momentum building, perhaps. I'd like to actually go back to talk about some of your early career experiences. You found yourself with a job at Pfizer and you did some interesting work there that perhaps sparked a lot of the things that you went on to do. Could you tell me a little bit about that story?
My job was to look over the R&D programs inside of the business, review their R&D projects, get insights from experts, you know, read papers and provide insights to the executives that were running, and then also be a part of the business development part of selling and buying businesses. But one day I was called to the CFO's office, Hank McKinnell, and he asked me to do a special project, which turned out to change my entire career. And the ask was, why is it that we buy these little companies, they're so innovative, they're so disruptive, they're doing amazing things, we buy them, and then all the innovations that they do after that are just so incremental and they don't really have as much impact anymore. Like, what's going on? I went out and interviewed all the founders and founding teams of those startups. I then interviewed the teams that were executing on the same projects internally. Many of them were different. The founders had scattered and observed some big differences. And one of the big differences was, where does it all start? When they're on their own and they're an innovator and they're out in the world, they're just trying to solve a problem and they're really trying to address a need. And they're looking out against all the possible technologies to solve that need and saying, which one is the best to solve my need? Once they become a successful balloon catheter company and they're acquired by Pfizer and you're in the angioplasty business and you're making balloons, they're asking the question, hey, what else can I use this balloon for? How can I make it better, stronger, faster? Good question, but not disruptive and not big and not that innovative and therefore less successful. So the simple observation was, if we really want to disrupt markets, create revolutionary big ideas that change the world, you need to look at the needs and start from the needs. And even if you're in a big company, forget about that investment you made in all those molders and blowers and all that stuff. And go talk to what customer do you want to focus on and go live with that customer, see what their needs are, create a framework for understanding those needs, then start inventing. And if you're lucky enough, something you invent you've got some technology there, great. But don't go force fit a technology that you already have into a problem just because you've invested in it. That would be wrong. You want to solve the problem the best way possible. And I came back to Hank and I said, here's my observations. And he said, all right, prove it. And he gave me some money internally to create a little incubator that we call Fresh Tech. And we basically broke the steps out into a process, took things that I learned from business school and other places. And I combined it in that process to create what we called the Fresh Tech process, or the PF because of Pfizer. That was the framework for the biodesign process, basically. And we adapted biodesign process to be an educational program to teach that. And I've used that process myself in my entrepreneurial career, all MoxieMed, all the other companies that I've started, and same process that we teach students here at Stanford. And that same process has resulted in, you know, just millions of patients being treated by our trainees who found their way through to create revolutionary technologies using that methodology.
that's really fascinating story, and I love how you say that somewhat serendipitously this really changed the course of your career, and that you were able to find some core fundamentals for how innovation happens right at the beginning there. And I wonder what happened next. What happened in Pfizer when you're in this incubator lab, and how did things go forward from there?
Yeah, so we did it. We had American Medical Systems was one of our divisions. It was a company that had been acquired because of a urological product, and they wanted to get into gynecology, so we went into gynecology, and we followed around gynecologists and OBGYNs and looked at what they did and found all sorts of interesting issues and problems and identified them. We screened them. We wrote need statements and identified criteria just like we do for biodesign, and we invented a bunch of solutions and presented them, and they were pretty exciting. And many of the areas that we found and many of the technologies proposed ultimately became therapies. Now, Pfizer didn't actually do all of them. It was more like, can we do this? Can we find the ideas? Once it came down to implementing, they were really, really slow. But the idea, the process of creating the innovation was definitely proven within the big company. And some of those projects did make it into patient care. But other features of the bigger business started to show themselves, like not invented here. You have a new project. How does it get any money? You know, like when you propose a new project in the middle of the year, who's going to fund that? We train a lot of big companies here at BioDesign today, and we encourage them, you need to leave a budget for the thing that you don't know that you are doing yet, which is very, very, very hard. But if you want to innovate and create new spaces, you have to do it. Otherwise, you're pitting yourself up against an impossible thing. So, I mean, I was too young. I was too junior. I wasn't able to change these cultural norms that had been forever in Pfizer. So that's when I left to become an entrepreneur. I just got a little frustrated. You know, I often say, like, I'm a reluctant entrepreneur because I didn't go after entrepreneurship because of that's what I really want to do. I did it because I realized I have to do that. If I really want to make a change in medicine, like, I have to do this, not be hindered by not invented here and budget issues and other political challenges. I have to go make it myself.
Is there anything else sort of structurally that businesses or hospital systems should be thinking about if they want to foster innovation that actually goes out into the world and is implemented?
In a perfect world, you want leaders in these service businesses to be thinking about the bigger picture and how new ideas have the potential to improve patient care, maybe even improve profitability, a hospital's standing. You'd like to see hospitals embracing new technologies rather than seeing them as extra cost. You know, but there's lots of hospitals that it's almost impossible to get something new to happen. And it's a mindset thing about how to run practice, how to run your service business, how to run a hospital or a clinic. We've built our businesses with people that see new technology as opportunity for them, and they embrace it, and it benefits them and the patients. And the ones that don't are left behind. So thank God for the early adopters and for the visionaries, because they have created the future. But it would be nice to see more.
And you've touched on with BioDesign this identify, invent, implement type of process. Obviously, it's more complicated than that, and there's a lot more to learn. But I'd be curious to hear your perspective. Are there any kind of through lines that might help you to understand if something is going to be more successful or not? Is it part of the process? Is it people? What does it look like?
The need statement and spec, the criteria, are your golden ticket to success, because that describes what the need is and what is not solved today. If you hit that, if you've done that right and you hit that criteria with your solution, that is the fundamental key. Even before it's been invented, you can assess what the market for that's going to be. If that's a big market, then if you solve it, it's a big outcome. Now, it's hard to get there. You have to raise money along the way and most of the time deliver a return to those investors that's reasonable if you do that process right.
I'm sure in the US and globally, policies around innovation, the FDA, other groups may constrain or enhance the innovation environment. And I'm curious to hear your take on perhaps the history of your experience dealing with those kinds of groups and what you're hoping for in the future.
Yeah, well, I took a substantial amount of time to work on FDA reform. Ultimately, we got a law passed here in the United States that was the Food and Drug Administration Innovation and Safety Act that really codified a number of changes that needed to be put into regulation to allow for innovation to proceed successfully. And that was like 10 years ago. And the whole universe for the way medical devices are regulated has changed. There's still more work to do, but it's made a positive change. And that has enlightened me that one can really actually do these things and make change. So we have started a policy program here at Stanford. We're going to focus on devices, diagnostics, digital health, and biotech. And then in those dimensions, we'll be looking at payment, regulatory, intellectual property, health equity, value in economics, as well as legislative affairs. And that framework we will apply and create research that's helpful for regulating these technologies, as well as train next generation policymakers to go out and be helpful, the FDA and CMS and the White House or Congress, with an enlightenment about what innovation is, what innovation needs, and then how these fields differ from one another as they think about policies that would support innovation for the future. It's really cool, and I hope it makes a big impact and hopefully brings some more sensitivity and thoughtfulness around innovation and making sure that the policies support it rather than throttle it.
Is there any particular areas that would be top of your list around policy change that could enhance innovation?
Yeah, the one that we got started on was reimbursement, specifically in medical technologies. But the findings are pretty devastating. How long an innovator has to wait in the United States, something with some modest level of coverage, it's many years after approval, many, many years. Our first survey, where we just got people's opinions, it was like 4.5 years or 4.7 years. It's looking to be more than that. Maybe much more. That is too long for innovative new technologies to wait to be covered. Who's paying for all that? How much more costly do the technologies wind up having to be for patients because someone's paying for everyone's salaries and the company be sticking around and waiting for this final ability to finally sell their product? It's not benefiting the system. So let's get these things used. Let's collect that data while it's being used. Let's learn from that experience. Those that are working well could start benefiting patients right away. It seems to be a really not well thought out structural issue that is hurting innovation. It's delaying access for patients, and it's bad for business. We need to shine a light on it. It needs to be fixed. Come up with a better way. Rather than viewing the new technology as the enemy and let's hope they just go away. If we keep on saying no, maybe they'll just go away. We can just do it the way we've done it for the last 20 years. We need to change it. So that's one of the things we'll be working on.
Well, that sounds very worthwhile. I'd love to go back to a comment you made around equity, because I think it is a really interesting question. When products first come out, they can be very expensive, or particular companies may only service people who are in a particular geographic region, what have you. I wonder how you view the space around innovation and its connection with equity in potentially exacerbating or reducing inequity.
My personal belief is the only way to make change is through innovation. I mean, the definition of innovation is like bringing something new. I mean, doing it the way we were doing it, that's not working. So if we want to get more people, you know, spread this wonderful healthcare system that we have, then we want to figure out ways of doing that less expensively, more efficiently, smarter, better. That's innovation. So I believe in innovation being a chief driver to address health equity. Therefore, I think by design, you know, the organization I'm leading now, is going to play an important role in that. in helping people have a methodology for addressing that. And I think that's important is just to have the lens, the awareness of how technologies can create equity or also they can create inequity. And to be aware of that and to have a thoughtful approach towards trying to solve that problem. I think actually addressing this reimbursement issue is one way to help equity. I mean, this is anytime the word patient access comes up, that is an equity problem. Because when access is difficult, guess who gets it? You know, if you can pay more, if you can spend more time, if you've got more resources, you're going to get it. And if you don't, you're not. And that's not right. I mean, people say, well, we can't afford it. We're right. Let's make it less expensive to get it here. How can we do it smarter so that it's less cost and therefore less risk? And therefore, the amount of return required to satisfy investors to be willing to take the risk on these things is more reasonable. And therefore, we can have a technology that's available to more people less expensively. It's all connected.
I wanted to ask about venture capital. What are venture capitalists seeing in the equity and innovation space?
There have been very few entrepreneurs who have figured out how to make equity something that's attractive from a venture capital returns basis. I do, however, believe that that is one of the goals. If we can make it attractive on an investment and return basis, it's going to happen. So helping innovators understand what the thresholds are really important so that they can design programs and products that can deliver those returns. And then I think venture capitalists are going to be interested. At the end of the day, they are supposed to make the greatest return. There are some that have other objectives that are more humanitarian, but they're primarily investors of money and looking for returns. So it's very similar to when we started BioDesign. People were very, very critical about BioDesign. Why are we teaching students to patent things? That's against our culture as a university. We should be just spreading the knowledge. Patenting is being secretive and you shouldn't be doing that. We should be teaching our students just to go out into the world and share all their insights. And that leads to other people having insights and all this kind of stuff. And I had to explain that when they do that, that ensures it's never going to happen because the whole world of investment and making things happen is about exclusivity. And the only way to get that exclusivity is through patents. So you need patents to inspire the investment because now you own this thing. And if you make it work and you get to exploit it, you are the owner of it and you will get the returns on it rather than years and years of developing, proving something could work. You prove it after all this expense and then everyone can do it. And all the investment that you made was just for the benefit of society, but good luck getting any return. It just doesn't work that way. You have to have patents to make improvements in healthcare. You have to have businesses that can earn a reasonable profit to improve patients' lives. It's all connected, and that's what we need to do for health equity. We need to connect improving patients' care and more patients and more patient access to viable and exciting business models that deliver return. And I think when we can do that, we will have solved the problem. And we did it on BioDesign over the last 22 years. We can do this for health equity too, and that's the mission on health equity.
One thing that I know you've been involved in is an international effort, and I think that also speaks to some of the equity goals that you have. Could you comment about what work you've been doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. So with this in mind, we have decided we are going to take BioDesign on the road. We've done this once before in India. We partnered with the government of India over the last 15 years to install BioDesign in many of the major universities in India. That has resulted in many, many entrepreneurs inventing and creating companies, which has inspired investment and jobs. And then bigger companies have moved in and bought some of those things. It's created this great ecosystem, robust ecosystem of innovation, jobs, healthcare, societal improvement by injecting BioDesign. So now we want to sort of take this on the road, create the model and show how it can be done in other areas. And so one of the areas is East Africa, and we're partnering with the faculty at University of Global Health Equity in Rwanda and also Kenyatta University in Kenya. And we will be building a BioDesign program to service the East African community, looking at their needs and then training people on how to, local people, on how to innovate and take those needs into ideas. And we're trying to get partners around this to make investments in those ideas. and build that ecosystem there in East Africa with a longer-term goal of using that experience to help others to see a pathway to do this in other regions of the world. And we're planning on making a long-term commitment. We'll be there for many, many years, and I think it's going to be successful. So that's how we're addressing global health equity, again, through BioDesign and installing it in a region with the goal of training the trainers.
And what did you learn from your experience with India?
We learned it's possible to do it. Even in low resource environments, it's possible. We learned other things too, like you need the right partners. You know, you need the right buy-in at the government level. You need a medical school involved. Engineering isn't enough. If you don't have the medical school there and they can't get access to patients, it's not good enough. All these sorts of details in terms of how do you set this up right for success. So there are many, many learnings, but the biggest takeaway is it can work. And so that gives us encouragement now that we can do it elsewhere, maybe even more fluidly and fast to achieve those goals now that we sort of understand the right framework to be successful.
Those networks that you're creating sound fascinating, and I look forward to watching how they grow. For a clinician who is looking to get into this space, where would you recommend sending them?
Our materials are out there. We have a textbook called BioDesign, Process of Innovating New Medical Technologies. It's pretty thick, but there's also online versions. You can go to biodesign.stanford.edu and learn more. We're always looking for great fellows. We have policy fellows that we would love to bring in. So lots of resources out there that you could follow this path to. And the key message is you can do it. Anyone can do it. You can learn it. You can get good at it. You can be successful as an innovator, even as a physician or any other background you have. As long as you follow the process and really focus on the needs, that's the key.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Josh MacOuer.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that brings us to the end of the podcast. If you want to go deeper about any of these topics or join the discussion, visit our website, clinicalchangemakers.com. Now, one small ask. This is a brand new podcast. So if you enjoyed our work, please rate us and share it with your friends and colleagues. Until next time, take care.